much. Thank you for coming in your lunch hour. Thank you for inviting me. This is a great honour, really, to be here. As a geographer who's interested in these sorts of things, I feel like I'm actually now talking to the grown-ups when it comes to the history of medicine, the history of alcohol in particular. This group of people is very interesting. I have attempted to rewrite some of these the claims I'm going to make, thinking what this audience would be like and thinking who'd be here, and I've probably got that completely wrong, so there's a possibility you've heard it all before, which will be rather embarrassing for me, or it may be odd and strange, which I guess I'm hoping for. But I'm trying to draw upon some work I'm sort of in the middle of, to talk about something which I think has some relevance for the way we consider alcohol now, as Martin was saying, questions really of I suppose harm, safety, risk and so on. But I've also been interested for several years now in the way in which we can turn to something as perhaps on the face of it peculiar as life assurance to look at alternative ways of valuing risk and the body and health and so on. Partly because I think certain other areas, particularly the kind of moral arguments about drinking, have been overworked. And because I think there's a closer link between medicine and life assurance, as I'm sure many of you know, and therefore there's a more productive engagement between those two fields in this broadly defined period. So anyway, the paper is, I'm going to read it, I'm afraid. I'm going to probably ad-lib a little as I go. The PowerPoint after that wait is not that impressive, but I hope you'll find it something to look at if you get fed up of looking at me. So just to start, I've always been quite persuaded by Mariana Valverde's arguments about alcohol, that the medicalisation of alcohol has never been entirely complete, it's never been entirely finished, partly because it's a hybrid project involving psychiatric, physiological and epidemiological elements. And these forms of proof, these forms of knowledge come together in quite awkward ways, I think. And that's one of the things I think is really interesting. It's kept the medicalisation of alcohol an open question in many parts of the world for quite a long time. Now, you may already want to disagree with that, but let's perhaps leave that for the last part of the discussion. In the second half of the 19th century in Britain, there was still a good debate about the consequences of drinking, whether it was something that needed to be done, whether it was something that was inherently harmful, or whether some kind of compromise could be struck. The disease theory of alcohol and alcoholism was emerging, was starting to dominate arguments in Britain, thanks to Dr. Norman Kerr and others. And I'm sure if you're interested in this period and in alcohol, you'll know something about history. There's also historians, I've never known how to pronounce her name, so Joanne Wyack, I think is her name, who has looked at the struggle between medical temperance, in other words, those doctors who are keen on abstinence, and effectively also prohibition. The struggle between that idea of alcohol in medicine and a more sort of traditional sense that it might also be sometimes a food, sometimes a form of medicine in its own right. But I think people haven't often examined the extent to which moderation as a sort of therapeutic response remained in the medical register all the way through the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century. What I'm going to talk about today is the way that moderation becomes something rather than just a sort of moralising thing about don't drink too much, but becomes actually an exact quantity, a quantity which then moves around from place to place doing different kinds of work as it falls into these different sorts of environments. And it becomes very useful in life insurance. And life insurance and medicine are kind of talking to each other through, I think, this idea of a safe limit, which is then going to bring me back to the unit very briefly at the end, because that's the kind of contemporary version, I think. Always risky to say that something in the past is it has a contemporary equivalent, but I'm going to make some arguments along those lines. So what I'm talking about today is not about inebriety and alcoholism, but about what we think of as harms now. The risks of the consequences of alcohol in terms of what it might do to the body in certain sorts of ways. I think it's also interesting that this brings in a population-based approach, a more epidemiological approach, so it's closer to public health approaches, even though most of what I'll be talking about today is done in the private sector through life insurance. But I think it's a very similar way of thinking about the alcoholic as part of a body of people and about things like norms and so on. Normal rates of consumption, normal averages, and a safe limit in that sense, than thinking about the individual body or the individual mind of the inebriate, the addict, the alcoholic, the problem drinker of the 20th century. So, the debate I'm talking about is between medicine and life insurance, and I suppose to some extent temperance. In Britain and in the US, because there's a geographical element to this argument, the argument I'm tracing is born in the UK out of a dialogue with European research on alcohol. I'm unfortunately unable to read some of that research. I'm going on the British response to that, but I welcome comments if anyone knows more about that. But then these ideas are taken to the US, they're taken up in the US and North America and elsewhere in the Anglophone world, largely, I think, through the relevance of these ideas to life insurance. So the argument moves through life insurance circles. Some writers seized upon the idea of a daily limit or allowance for personal consumption in the second half of the 20th century, and they defined it as a particular amount of pure alcohol, so they're concentrating on alcoholic content, much as the unit is based on alcoholic content too. And this was seized upon because it gave them an alternative to the other strategies that doctors were adopting, which is basically medical temperance and abstinence as a response, or a sort of anything goes, you know, it's just good for you, stop moaning, which is dying out, I think, as a strategy. So this definition of moderation is likely to have been more influential, I think, than the vague advice of moralists, because it's tied to something that might actually have had consequences for people's lives, the calculation of risk for life insurance. If you went to have a life insurance policy, you would be examined by a medical expert who would then make a decision on whether you would get that policy or not, or whether you would pay more for it or not, based on what they thought of your health. And that meant that their idea of how risky alcohol was would actually have consequences for your pocket, it might have consequences for how you lived, it might make you change your behaviour. All of these are ifs, but I think I will later be making an argument that those ifs might actually have been quite influential in changing both medical practice and perhaps the way people responded to alcohol in the general population. So the outline of the paper starts with a brief consideration of an extraordinary debate, as it was called, in 1893. We then go back in time to consider the idea of moderation in medicine, in British medicine, with Anstey and other doctors being the focus of this. You may know the name of Anstey. We will then talk about how insurance and inebriety came together in particular ways, and how this might have produced this sense of moderate drinking and certainly transmitted this sense of moderate drinking. And then I will talk about how this became even more closely enshrined in insurance practice in the early 20th century, particularly in the United States, and how that then led to a further questioning of whether this safe limit was genuinely safe. And in conclusion, I will then cause all kinds of trouble by trying to work out whether there is something we can learn about the unit from all this historical material. So in 1893, Sir Dyce Duckworth was responsible for what a Reuters correspondent called an extraordinary debate, and he presented a paper on the physiological effects of alcohol on the human organism at the 4th International Congress on the Abuse of Alcohol at The Hague. At this point, Duckworth was physician and lecturer on medicine at Barts. He was a physician to the Prince of Wales. He held a number of senior positions at the Royal College of Physicians over the course of his career. He was knighted in 1886 and would be made a baronet in 1909. So he's the classic establishment doctor. His best-known work on alcohol was his treatise on gout, published in 1889. So he has some expertise. But the words that he spoke at this conference caused a great deal of distress. The Reuters journalist noted, "It became evident before he proceeded far with it that it was an advocacy, not a total abstinence, to which the majority of those present were pledged, but of moderate drinking, as conducive to health and general well-being. From an early stage in the reading of the paper, the faces of the audience became an interesting study. They expressed in rapid succession perplexity, suspicion, embarrassment, consternation, and indignation." Duckworth was arguing that alcohol had its uses within limits. Quote, "He knew of no evidence to prove that a moderate consumption of alcoholic liquid taken with other food was injurious to the best health of the textures of the human body or incapacitated it for its highest functions." He could give no exact definition of what moderation meant in this matter for most people, but he assumed that the utmost limit or equivalent of alcohol taken in any day should not exceed 1 ounce or 1.5 ounces. So he does have a fairly good idea, I think, of what the limit is, and it's a limit that he had borrowed that was the culmination of 30 years of arguing amongst the British medical, I don't know if establishment is the right word, but amongst medical thought. And this is also, note, about a daily limit. It's about something you can do every day. So it's thinking about frequency and pattern of drinking already, rather than just the sort of total consumption. Duckworth finished by saying that he offered no apology for statements which controverted much teaching now prevalent. He was hissed as he left the stage. A few delegates expressed their support for his argument. There were some interesting comments of support from Holland and from elsewhere in Europe, but many others were hostile. Joseph Malins, who was the Grand Chief of the Order of Good Templars, an important temperance leader, was predictably dismissive, but he added one interesting point when he said, "No great insurance company would insure Sir Duckworth's life as a moderate drinker at so low a rate as they would were he himself a teetotaler." We will return to life insurance in a moment, but it's interesting that one of the ways that Malins tried to establish a kind of alternative value for drinking and abstinence was through life insurance. This debate was reported very widely in the press, or certainly in the Anglophone press. It turns up in Canada, San Francisco, New Zealand. And it suggests that this was then, in a sense, news. It had to be reported because it was particularly interesting, although it's happening in August, so perhaps it's a silly season thing. Duckworth became a hero to the drink trade, rather predictably. He was praised by the manager of the Tadcaster Tower Brewery Company as he addressed his employees on their works outing to Whitby. He was also praised by the president of the Bristol and District Beer, Spirit and Wine Trade Protection and Benevolence Association at their quarterly meeting. So he'd said exactly the right thing for them. This is the moment at which prohibitionists in British politics are attempting, well, they have been for some time, but they're trying to speed up the process by which alcohol could be outlawed, either by local option or by a national decree in Britain. So against the teeth of this kind of seemingly prohibitionist mood, here is Duckworth saying, a little bit is okay. So clearly he's going to be popular. Other writers saw the potential, though, of setting a limit at this point. They said maybe moderation is quite useful. A letter to the Sheffield and Rotherham Independent was generally critical of Duckworth, pointed out if his limit was right, then there were many more moderate drinkers out there than had been previously imagined. So if you set it low, all of a sudden all these people become problem drinkers. He said, your report to the Congress should make all moderate drinkers hesitate before they swallow their intoxicants. An editorial in the North Eastern Daily Gazette noted that the limit was so low that observance of it would speedily mean the reduction of all the race of opulent brewers to beggary. Duckworth, despite this, despite the extraordinary nature apparently of this debate, was not all that far from the mainstream position of British medicine at the end of the century, in this last 10 years before the turn of the century. This position was that moderation was effectively safe, that there was a safe limit for drinking, but also that abstinence is not a dangerous practice. There is a window between nothing and little, which is a safe place to be if you are drinking every day. There were, of course, still some writers who were dubious about the safety of moderation. There is the medical temperance tradition. There are people like Victor Horsley at UCL or UCH writing in the early 20th century who are still arguing very strongly that any drink is bad for the human body. Abstinence was still something that doctors could turn to as a sort of therapeutic suggestion. We also have to remember that at the same time people are arguing about inebriety, addiction, about starting to think about whether you could be born an alcoholic, whether this was hereditary, because there is this discussion about eugenics and so on. So this muddies the waters a little bit when people are trying to work out what is safe, because that's a slightly different way of phrasing the question. However, I think it's possible to identify something, as I said, that is a bit like the mainstream position in British medicine at the end of the century when it comes to moderation and safety. And to explore this further, we have to think about the last 30 years or so before Duckworth's paper, where people have been trying to work out whether alcohol was harmful or not. We then need to think about how insurance then shaped these arguments, or reflected them, took them on and publicised them, before looking at the early 20th century and the way in which the two came together in a very productive fashion in the United States. Actuarial records provided another form of evidence beyond the experience of the physician or experimental laboratory work, and these were the main ways in which people made their claims to truth. So Duckworth is one of those sort of establishment doctors who doesn't do any laboratory work. He's very sniffy of people who experiment on animals or experiment on people or themselves, and he just knows because he's been a physician for many, many years. It's that sort of tacit knowledge that he calls upon, and his own authority as a society doctor, I guess. Other people, as we'll see in a moment, did rely on experimentation, but actuarial experience is effectively a bit like the epidemiological knowledge that some public health people still use today. It's about large data sets, effectively. It's about mortality, and there's a very strong link between the science of demography and the science of actuarialism in the 19th century. So that's an alternative source of evidence that I'll be thinking about. But unfortunately for this debate, it could be used both to justify abstinence and moderation, as we'll see. Okay, so let's think about medicine and moderation. And we're going to spend a bit of time talking about this man, Francis Edmund Anstey, and his eponymous limit. So before we talk about Anstey, there were a number of different ideas about alcohol circulating in the British medical profession in the second half of the 19th century. There was medical temperance, who saw it as a poison. There were those who would prescribe it, either as a food or as a curative, or perhaps just use it as something to carry medicines in. This is still going on in some places. And then there were people who would counsel moderation. But what did moderation mean? Was it simply just a general thing about cutting down, or could it become something slightly more specific? The early British temperance movement, and by this I mean the 1920s and 30s, was 1820s and 30s, was sometimes described as moderationist because it said, don't drink spirits, drink little, but it didn't really specify the quantity of alcohol. It certainly didn't really think about how much was okay as a daily limit. By the time these people are researching alcohol, the emphasis in temperance is very much abolitionist, prohibitionist, teetotal. So moderation has ceased to be a personal and political goal for the temperance movement. So these medical people are exploring it in the teeth of temperance opinion. That needs to be remembered as well. So some in the medical profession tried to engage with abstainers and abolitionists to argue that they were going down the wrong path because they were convinced that moderate consumption was inherently healthy. One of the most important people to say this was Francis Anstey. Anstey was a lecturer and physician at the Westminster Hospital and was closely engaged in public health. I'm sure many of you know who he was. He was the editor of The Practitioner, a magazine, a journal set up for ordinary practitioners, which was very practical, very useful. But he was also the author of The Lancet's report on workhouse infirmaries and an agitator for what he called state medicine. In a way, he's become more famous for that than his work on alcohol and other narcotics. But in the 1860s and 1870s, he made three important points when he was discussing and researching alcohol. He challenged earlier medical orthodoxies, engaging in research to do so. He argued that the effect of alcohol was largely dependent upon the dose administered, so that it wasn't something inherent in the property, but in the way it reacted with other things, including your body. And he insisted that a scientific case for moderate consumption should be made despite the fierce opposition of teetotalers. One of the last things he did before he died was propose a declaration that was, I think, organised by the British Medical Journal, which more or less said, we, the British Medical Journal, the doctors of the BMA, effectively don't think alcohol should be used by doctors. And he opposed that because he wanted to remain committed to his view on moderation. So he flew in the teeth of the rest of the profession there. But at this point, he's still establishing what moderation might be. Earlier in the 19th century, Justus von Liebig had argued that alcohol was a food, but more recent research by the French researchers Lallemand, Duloy and Perrin had suggested that it passed through the body unchanged, that it was a sort of, it was a poison, but it effectively didn't interact with the body in any useful way, and it just left the body without doing anything. Anstey rubbished this research. He developed chemical tests to detect alcohol in urine, breath and sweat, and he explored the use of Marais's new sphygmograph, and you're always going to stumble over that, to show how alcohol affected the pulse. So this is the way you check pulse and heartbeat. He also asked Dr. Auguste Dupré, a colleague at the Westminster Hospital, to conduct parallel experiments to test his own responses to alcohol. So here's a man who's committed to this emerging sense of a kind of scientific, laboratory-based research into alcohol, using himself as a research subject, but still otherwise being very careful in the way he goes about it. All of this simply confirmed his suspicion that alcohol was not simply poison, medicine, or food in its own right, but had different effects in different doses. It could be all of those things. Anstey believed that the human body could cope with alcohol up to a certain dose, and in some situations might need it. So he was interested in the argument that if people were suffering from fever, they couldn't take regular food, but they could be given alcohol, which seemed to act as a food for them. And he was also interested that that didn't seem to get them as drunk as a healthy person would have been. He said the poison line shifted in that situation, which led him to the argument that really that poison line was something that could be affected by other situations. It was a, it was something which, alcoholism and intoxication was something which came out of the meeting of different elements rather than a simple consequence of ingestion of alcohol. Up to a certain dose then, it's okay. Beyond that, several things happen. First, alcohol ceases to be a food and a stimulant, and it becomes a sedative with obvious narcotic effects. The drinker feels drunk or is observed to be drunk. How we know that is a different matter. I don't actually know how Anstey decided what somebody meant by drunk in that situation. But anyway, that's where he thinks drunkenness begins, when the body cannot cope with the excess alcohol. Secondly, excess alcohol begins to be eliminated from the body in quantities that could be detected by the tests that Anstey had spent years perfecting. So you could actually prove in a laboratory that people were starting to, yes, sorry, I shouldn't really talk about this at lunch, but starting to eliminate that alcohol. Thirdly, the drinker risked alcoholic poisoning, i.e. the alcohol became poisonous and harmful beyond this point. As he put it in 1862, so long as there is any need for alcohol in the system, it will fail to intoxicate. The moment that the faintest symptom of intoxication appears, we may be sure that the further use of this agent would be injurious. By 1867, Ansi's experiments had established what this dose actually was for healthy men. This is something he was always careful to qualify. The threshold would be a daily allowance of 1 or 1.5 ounces of absolute alcohol, which he described as an amount of absolute alcohol which our own experimental researchers have shown to be about the limit of what can be habitually taken by persons leading a not very active life without provoking symptoms of chronic malaise indicative of actual alcohol poisoning. He pointed out that sedentary types, I mean very sedentary types, because his average person is fairly sedentary, children and the elderly should drink less, but sherry was okay for children. Anstey warned that many middle and upper class drinkers, who he described as the moderate diners out and virtuous dancing young ladies, were actually drinking up to twice as much as his limit. So once he's established the limit, he can then see a new population of people who are at risk, who weren't at risk before anyone drew the line that low. He said, "I don't mind that I've shocked these people. I want them and their doctors to confront the facts." Anstey warned that few people knew very much about what he called the comparative alcohol potency of different drinks, and this ignorance was compounded by variations in glass sizes, which he thought were getting bigger. This is all probably sounding familiar to people who've been observing the unit arguments. He was also thinking that people were confused by the vagueness of patients' descriptions. So doctors often didn't know how much 2 glasses of sherry at lunch meant when their patients told them that. Was it a large glass? Was it a small glass? Was it strong sherry? Was it weak sherry? Whatever. So Anstey is trying to quantify this, and he provides useful translations of what this measure means in terms of different drinks. Sometimes it's a bottle of wine, depending on the wine. He published a book on wine as a food and as a form of alcohol. Sometimes it's something that people express in just this kind of ounces of pure alcohol form. He died in 1874, he was still in his early 40s, but his daily allowance was taken up by influential writers on public health and hygiene. Probably the most famous is Edmund Alexander Parkes. I don't need to explain who he is, hopefully, to anyone here. His manual of practical hygiene drew upon 3 sources in his discussion of drinking. He talked about Anstey's research, he talked about his own research, some of it with Count Cyprian Volovitz, and he talked about actuarial records. So Parkes was also consulting the actuarial records of life insurance companies to see whether there was any evidence of certain kinds of activity, including drinking, being risky and providing a higher mortality rate for those people. Like Anstey, Parkes and Volovitz found that between 1 and 2 fluid ounces a day, quote, begins to produce effects which can be considered injurious in a healthy man and moderate drinker. He pointed out this was 2.5 pints of weak table beer, 1.5 pints of strong beer, etc., in the same way that Anstey provided this useful ready reckoner of how much you could have per day. But he was also prepared to admit another kind of evidence because he'd read this actuarial stuff. He noted that very striking evidence in favour of total abstinence as contrasted with moderation is given by the experience of the United Kingdom Temperance and General Providence Institution. These actuarial records appeared to make the effects of drinking visible to all. They set it out in what appeared to be an incontrovertible fashion, which meant that Parkes wavered between recommending moderation and recommending abstinence. However, because he was slightly swayed by the temperance records, the insurance records of the temperance organisation, it meant that he started to think that any amount might be harmful. So he's not distinguishing between safe and unsafe. He's saying it's safer than having a lot, but it's still riskier than having nothing. This is something which starts to undermine the clarity of Anstey's limit as we go through. Other people adopted Anstey's work, including his friend Sir Benjamin Richardson, who'd been a champion of medical temperance, but was more open-minded than that suggests, pioneer of the sanitary movement, so again, I suspect he's known to a few people here. He wrote an essay on moderate drinking for and against, which tended to be against, but he also recognised Parkes' dietetic dose. He attributed it to Parkes rather than to Anstey, but it is the same thing, still 1.5 ounces of pure alcohol. And he says, if you are healthy and you wish to, you can drink that much, probably without any danger. But he was also reading this actuarial data and starting to worry about the conflicting forms of evidence that were there. One final use of this figure of 1 to 1.5 ounces of absolute alcohol serves to show, I think, kind of in relief, just how central this idea had become to mainstream medical opinion. In 1891, which is just before Duckworth's address in the Netherlands, a society doctor and gout specialist named Dr. Mortimer Granville wrote to the Times, claiming that incalculable harm has been done to the human organism by the spread of teetotal views and practices. There's less stamina in the life of the average Englishman than there was 40 years ago. He drew upon, I guess, what we would now see as eugenic arguments about the decline of the race and so on, but he was clear that it was temperance that was at fault and that really people needed to be drinking. His letter obviously provoked debate, much of it very hostile, and in the correspondence that followed, which goes on for ages, Granville's the kind of person who would post to a list now and be on there all the time, every minor opinion. He's extraordinarily annoying. It becomes clear that he accepts that 2 ounces of pure alcohol was, quote, the limit beyond which no person should go without express medical advice. So he does use the limit himself to say that, you know, beyond that, there is danger. But he thought drinking less than this was dangerous as well. Quote, the neglect to supply the average organism with its due quantity of alcohol is a cause of debility and diminished power resistance to disease. Essentially, he made Anstey's daily allowance a necessary quantity of alcohol per day. One newspaper subtitled its treatment of this story a plea for the use of more alcohol. Recognising the limits set out by Anstey, Parkes, etc., meant paying attention to the problems of knowledge and responsibility it raised. So Granville's also interesting for anticipating what we now think of as health marketing, I think. He said, first of all, we need to know what this would mean in terms of different drinks. So like all these other writers, he tells us what it would mean in terms of wine or beer. But he then called for an Act of Parliament to make retailers of drink responsible for giving information about alcoholic content on labels, at bars, everywhere where drinkers would come into contact with alcohol. Right from the start, he accepted that in taking this position, quote, I am placing myself in antagonism to the majority of medical writers on this topic, which is what Duckworth said, but Duckworth, I think, was not quite so far away from the mainstream. One writer, in response, dismissed Granville's arguments by saying, Dr. Mortimer Granville is a gout specialist, consequently very little brought into contact with abstainers, which of course is true, I guess in the way that they understood gout then, and his contributions are not seriously regarded by the profession. This was referring to an editorial in the British Medical Journal, which was summarising this discussion, which said, a more thoughtless and inaccurate letter has perhaps hardly ever appeared in the public press. It was full of propositions in favour of the habit of drinking, so extravagantly worded, so devoid of evidence, and it may fairly be said, so contrary to fact, that it is deplorable that any educated medical man should have been willing to append his name to it. The piece goes on to say, no evidence has been produced to suggest that drinking in itself, moderate drinking, is injurious. On the other hand, it's not only presumptuous but mischievous for any man to assert that abstinence from alcoholic drink is, except perhaps in an infinitely small number of cases, injurious to health. So clarifying in response to Granville that abstinence was not harmful and moderation was probably entirely safe for most people. Just a quick point here about what happened in the US. I'm less certain about this. I should do some more research on this. But I think it's very significant that the Committee of 50, which is a very influential research group researching alcohol towards the end of the century and into the 20th century, but in one of their publications, they actually cite Anstey's limit explicitly, saying this is the English view on safe amount of alcohol. I think this is significant given that the committee is thought to have established the idea of moderate drinking that dominated American drink policy after the repeal of Prohibition. So, in a sense, what they were saying fell on deaf ears because Prohibition was about to happen. But once Prohibition had gone, people returned to this sense that actually a certain amount of drinking was okay. And I've yet to prove this bit because it's after the Second World War. There may well be a way in which Anstey's limit is taken up by people thinking about how they set that safe limit. But anyway, I'm off the stuff I know about. Let's go back to that. So let's think about insurance then. I haven't really said very much about that so far. If we return to Duckworth's 1893 paper, we have to remind ourselves that for many in the temperance movement, it was abstinence and prohibition rather than moderation that they expected him to be talking about. Joseph Malin's reaction, remember, was to claim that Duckworth wouldn't get a cheap life insurance policy from a decent life insurance company. Both of these beliefs, both of those statements, drew upon the work of temperance life assurance companies, particularly the United Kingdom Temperance and General Provident Institution, the people I've been researching for what seems like forever. The UKT is how I'm going to refer to them in future, which is one of the 10 largest providers of life insurance in Britain in the 1890s. It was actually, given that it was partly a temperance company, it was actually successful, extremely successful, and gave a lot of other companies a run for their money. Established in 1840, it had ended up with two parallel sections. There's a very long story about this. I can go into it if you're interested. They had two sections, one for abstainers, the temperance section, and one for non-abstainers, who were all thought to be moderate drinkers. If they were excessive drinkers, they weren't allowed to have a life insurance policy, which was the policy of many companies. So the general section and temperance section are run entirely separately. The amount of money in each one is entirely separate. They're charged the same fees for their premiums and their policies, but this is a mutual, so all the profit that is made is returned to the members. What happens, and what's very interesting to temperance people, is that the people in the temperance section, you can see this is a classic kind of way that people would present this. This is Dawson Burns presenting this argument. The expected deaths were always much lower in the temperance section than they were in the general section, which meant that they didn't have to pay out so much money. That meant there was more money left to be divided amongst the teetotalers in the temperance section, and they were better off as a result. This seemed to give a monetary value to staying off the wagon. But it also meant that you could track mortality figures very accurately. These are just 5 years' worth of figures, but they ended up with 60-odd years by the time I'm talking about this discussion. 60 years of mortality experience, having insured tens of thousands of people, with these two separate sections consistently suggesting that if you didn't drink, you lived much longer. So this was used, as you can imagine, by temperance campaigners. It was a key part of the argument. This is how I became interested in this company, because they kept cropping up as another form of proof beyond the moral and medical of the value of abstinence. One actuary of the company described this process as, those who don't drink don't die so fast. When he was asked whether there was some kind of preferential treatment for the people in the temperance section, he said, no, it is a law of mortality, it's a law of health. So that gives you a sense of the kind of evidence people were appealing to and the way in which it was considered to be something I guess you couldn't argue with. It provided a sound business model for other firms. I found at least 14 British, American, Canadian and New Zealand companies organised on the same principles or similar principles. Many of them explicitly referred to the UKT as a model and effectively have stolen their business model in another territory. This kind of insurance seemed to offer a new weapon against inebriety and a new kind of evidence in the form of these comparative mortality rates. And I think it's also interesting that it recruited different kinds of people to the sorts of doctors that we've already talked about, rather than Anstey or Duckworth, people associated with the big teaching hospitals or the big society posts. We have people like Dr. Ralph Grindrod, who was a medical referee for the United Kingdom Temperance and General Provident Institution in 1840 when it started. He was a teetotaler, arguably the first person to sign up to medical temperance and to promote abstinence as a medical argument. He was someone who would check applicants for life insurance policies and would tell the company whether they were healthy or not, whether they were drinking or not, whether they were therefore a good risk or not. He is a very modest man, he's a very awkward man, he comes from a classic nonconformist background, he ends up running a hydropathy spa in Malvern. He's a classic outside doctor of that kind. He is very different, I think. And that, I think, tells you something about the way in which these sorts of knowledge and these sorts of arguments were circulating in a different group of doctors at this point. I think, though, that we have some evidence that other ordinary physicians who acted as medical referees for life insurance firms were encouraged to at least act as if immoderate consumption of alcohol was dangerous. So even if they didn't necessarily believe that alcohol was bad for you, they were encouraged to act as if it was, in the way that they classified and graded applicants for life insurance policies. So life insurance becomes a very big business. More and more people are having life insurance policies. It's calculated that I think 30% of the British population had a life insurance policy of some kind by the end of the century. And obviously that tended to be one per household, so many more households proportionally would have been insured in some way. Those people all had to get checked out by doctors. That meant that ordinary practitioners were involved more and more in the process of vetting people. Marguerite Dupré has looked at some of this, some very interesting work on how it changed not just the way in which the medical profession earned its money, but the way it went about its daily practice. This is all about diagnosing problems, looking at people who might be well but are not coming to you because they have a particular condition to report. So it kind of fine-tunes people's skills of diagnostics and so on. But what's interesting is that the companies that were getting all these local doctors to do this worried about standardisation. They worried that there might be differences in what appeared to be health and healthiness in different parts of the country. So they set out handbooks for medical examiners involved in life insurance, giving advice about how to do this, which in a sense is a kind of training manual for people, not just in terms of the life insurance analysis, but would also have communicated a great deal of medical information as well. I consulted 14 of these, published between 1863 and 1935, and they all asked referees to look out for signs of drunkenness. At first, this is often a very general and slightly moral warning that these people are a bad risk, but it doesn't tell you how much is too much. Later on, handbooks are starting to quantify, or asking examiners rather, to quantify the applicant's consumption in terms of pure alcohol. Charles Lyman Green, who is an American professor of medicine in Minnesota, director of the Minnesota Mutual Life Insurance Company, and one-time president of the National Association of Life Insurance Examining Surgeons, so someone who's both in medicine and in life insurance, pointed out, there are many kinds of drinkers, and between beer and spirit drinker, there is little to choose, provided the amount consumed to be excessive. So he, like Anstey, is starting to argue that what's important is the amount of alcohol, rather than the type of drink, which is relatively new. The fourth edition of Pollock and Chisholm's Medical Handbook of Life Insurance from 1895 seems to fit Anstey's arguments. But it's not until 1908, Edward Brockbank's Life Insurance and General Practice, that we see a direct reference to the physiological amount of 1.5 ounces of pure alcohol, which is the daily limit which is thought to be safe. It's attributed to Parkes rather than Anstey, but it's still, I think, the thing I've been looking for. So by this point, and then into the 20th century, insurance examiners are being asked to use this as a way of measuring alcohol consumption and deciding whether somebody's drinking is safe or unsafe. James Patterson McLaren, who's a South African physician writing one of these books, Cape Town, says, what is the amount of alcohol which does not do the body harm? Which is practically equal to asking, what is a sober and temperate person in the insurance sense? And his answer is to ask a physiologist, ask Anstey, ask Parkes, it's 1.5 ounces of pure alcohol. So that's 1927. I think by this point it's become something which is not everywhere, but it's become a sort of standard watchword, I think. Whether or not medical referees agreed with these arguments about risk and moderation is, in a sense, not the point, I think. You can disagree if you like. The companies that employed them took a very dim view of doctors who exposed them to unnecessary risks. So they were trying to discipline doctors into obeying these rules, whether or not they agreed with them themselves. If a doctor was to let too many bad risks through, and those people then died of what seemed to be inebriety, and there were court cases and it was all very messy, then the company would cease to employ those doctors. That's the theory. So I'm thinking that the popularity of life insurance and this kind of general standardisation of practice, at least in the medical exam for life insurance, may have standardised practice, may have standardised an understanding of risk in the minds of ordinary practitioners. Okay, moving on to the early 20th century, the connection goes even further then between alcohol medicine and life insurance. This is because the American firms started to dominate even the British market. American life insurance becomes enormous in the early 20th century, particularly the New York Life, the biggest company in Britain and elsewhere in 1900. But in America, they seem to be already using Anstey's limits, slightly earlier than they do in this country, but already starting to become slightly nervous about it. In 1901, Duckworth gave another paper on the employment of alcoholic drinks from a life assurance point of view. He made more or less the same arguments and got the same kind of response. But in the States, an anonymous correspondent writing for the Journal of the American Medical Association said that he thought this Anstey's dose of 2 ounces was far too much. He thought that that wasn't really something that the life insurance data he was used to looking at seemed to support as a safe limit of consumption. So people are already starting to want to dial down the amount of alcohol that people are consuming, and they're using actuarial information to make this case. In fact, this point was shortly to be reviewed by the United States life insurance industry. In 1908, a committee of 43 older United States life insurance companies, which is a large proportion of the sector, shared their mortality experience with each other in order to improve their sense of what was a good risk and what was a bad risk. The idea being that if you only had people from a particular area and that area was subject to particular risks, diseases or particular occupational hazards, then you had a very skewed sense of what was safe. If you put them all together across the US, you could standardise and hopefully come up with some general conclusion. One of the things they looked at in this medico-actuarial investigation was drinking. It was chaired by Arthur Hunter, the actuary of the New York Life, so effectively the most important actuary in America, if not the world, in terms of his influence. By 1914, he was able to report that one of the largest groups insured by these companies were those characterised as indulging in the steady, free use of alcohol. In other words, they were drinking every day, and they're drinking quite a lot of it. Now, this means they're not spree drinkers. This is not binge in that sense. This is people who consume regularly. But that group was quite large, and it could be further divided, quote, according to whether a conservative or a liberal interpretation of the expression steady free use had been adopted. In the latter section, the liberal interpretation would place the risks from those companies which use the standard as high or higher than Anstey's limit of 2 ounces of alcohol per day. In the former, conservative, all the companies which use less than entity's limit. So entity's limit is now being used to stratify the entire industry, to say which companies are being safe and which companies are not being safe, rather than just which individual decisions are safe and unsafe. A couple of years later, Eugene Lyman Fisk, who's a writer on health in the United States, says the man who passes entity's limit goes into a substandard class, and a poor substandard class at that. While individually he may escape, he belongs to a class that's fated to lose twice as many men in the same space of time as the general average. He's not actually reporting the figures correctly there, but something like 80%, 86% more mortality in the higher class, people over entity's limit. But it's still a significant difference. Again, in 1922, Oscar Rogers, who was the chief medical officer at New York Life, so a colleague of Hunter, in response to a further investigation, gives the sort of death knell to a confident use of entity's limit. The evidence conclusive that it's far too liberal. There appears to be no limit within which alcohol may be entirely harmless. It's as if there's a direct relation between the amount of alcohol used and the amount of damage done to the body. So based on their review of the evidence, they're starting to think that even the limit is too generous. So while it seems possible that some firms were using the 1.5 ounce limit to decide who was at risk and who wasn't, the industry was also using it itself to decide which companies were safe and which companies were not safe. And I think that this probably might have been spread to examiners. It might have been something that they absorbed and took up in their own practice and their own belief. Of course, at this point, prohibition is happening, and it gets very complicated. I don't really want to go into what happens here. It's further complicated by the publication of Raymond Pearl's study, Alcohol and Longevity, in 1926, which is where the J-shaped curve arrives. Do I need to say what a J-shaped curve is? I'm not going to draw one, but it's effectively the argument we have now that a couple of drinks a day is good for you. No drinks, bad. Lots of drinks, very bad. But it's that J-shaped curve which suggests that mortality actually improves with a small amount of alcohol. And that becomes the way in which people define moderation through the 20th century when that comes back in. And I think, again, now into the 21st century, it's what we think of as a safe limit, as defined by the bottom of the J-shaped curve. So it gets complicated, and I'm not going to go any further because I'm off my patch. But in conclusion, then, I'd argue that medical arguments for moderate consumption appeared earlier than we might have expected if we're looking only for a debate between abstainers and people who think alcohol is fine. There is this much more complicated position in the middle. This position became relatively sophisticated when it acquired a daily limit. It actually quantified what was safe or relatively safe. At the same time, the use of medical referees for life insurance helped communicate these ideas to ordinary practitioners through advice and handbooks, and through, I think, the disciplining of doctors by firms. The experience of the UKT persuaded some authorities that all drinking was dangerous, though. And while the US insurance industry seems to have adopted the limit as a way of distinguishing between safe and unsafe risks, it too began to see it as too generous, as Rogers says here, and to question the idea of a safe allowance. The dialogue between medicine and life insurance seems to have been a key and until now largely neglected place for the formation of ideas and practices concerning alcohol, in other words. I think I will leave it there, but I wanted to just highlight some conclusion points. Sorry. I want to leave plenty of time for questions, if people have them, but I also wanted to just put these up. If we were to think about parallels between today and now, I think there are plenty. These are some that I thought of between various positions that were advanced by people in the late 19th century and early 20th century, and you can read those, and things that people have said now. And they all really come out of the basic point that if you define a limit, you're then drawing a line beyond which certain sorts of things happen. But what does that limit mean? Is it a limit of safety, or is it a limit that is safer than something else? Is consumption necessary? Granville, this slightly old doctor who's way out of opinion, the kind of pattern of opinion in the 19th century, he would now love the J-shaped curve. That would vindicate him entirely. Forms of health marketing. Granville again, this odd character, saying we should advertise alcoholic content on drink labels. Ultimately, my argument has been, and this is where I think I can make a case for a parallel, that entity's limit was useful only in certain situations. It may have been useful in medical practice. It was particularly useful for actuaries because it gave them a straightforward limit beyond which they could classify people as a different kind of risk. I think it was therefore more productive because it worked in that world, in that relationship, much more effectively than it might have done in others. its usefulness then was as something that could be translated. And I think this does parallel debates about the modern alcoholic unit, which was described as the gold standard. Now, I think we often think about the gold standard as being, I don't know, like blue chip, but there's a gold to the standard. But I think what was interesting about the unit, and what might still be of interest about the unit, is that it can travel quite easily, that it can be a useful tool for people in public health talking to GPs. It can be a tool that's useful for health marketing people to translate some of that into something that they can then target at consumers. A lot of the debate, of course, about the unit has said that that's the bit that doesn't work, that consumers don't understand it, that they get confused by quantity, they get confused because they don't know what's in drinks and so on. That, though, doesn't mean that the unit fails. It only fails in social marketing. It works very well when public health people are trying to calculate how populations cope or do not cope with harm and risk in that sense. So the unit is useful in contemporary life insurance. Your GP may well be asked to return that kind of information if you say you've got a drinking problem, or if you say you're drinking too much and you have other health issues, because it is a useful measure. It travels very usefully in that way to life insurance companies now. If it doesn't work in other contexts, fine, but I don't think the unit's something that I think we should disagree with just because it seemed to appear out of a rather smoky, strange place. Okay, I've rambled on, I'll stop there. Thank you.